Aroused, April to May 1906. The demons we passed had the strangest looks on their faces, too. Once they had been rich and wealthy, and now all they owned were the clothes on their backs and their lives, and they were in danger of losing those, too. They looked shocked, as if not quite believing that all of this could happen to them. I could not help remembering what fine houses and mansions had once been there, and what richly dressed demons had eaten and drunk within them. And now they were all gone in less than a minute. The demons we met would have been grateful now for a crust of bread or a cup of water, things they would have turned their backs on just 12 hours ago. I felt very small. As we walked up the now deserted streets, Lefty warned us to watch out for demon soldiers.
"They shoot anybody they find, because they assume that the person is a looter. But the soldiers are looters themselves. When I was coming here, I saw them drive one family out of their house, and the owners were no sooner out of sight than they broke in and stole everything in sight."
"But the demon soldiers we met were good to us," Father said. "They told us about the wagon."
"That was because you had a demoness with you," Lefty grinned. "From now on, trust to your feet and not to your good fortune."
Once down the hill, we saw figures in khaki uniforms moving about. Lefty motioned us away, and we eased back to the top of the hill where we would be out of sight. Then we hid behind a mound of rubble that had once been a house. We spent an anxious half hour there. From down the hill, we heard the sound of breaking glass and rough, coarse laughter, and then 6 demon soldiers walked by, their blanket rolls bulging with loot, valuables tucked into their belts. One demon even had a bushel basket full of trinkets. Their bayoneted rifles were slung over their shoulders, and their very red faces made me think they had been drinking stolen liquor. They were puffing away on fat cigars. I suppose the cigars were stolen, too. It was kind of scary. One day we were living in a law-abiding community, and the next day the city and the community had both dissolved, with every person for himself. It struck me that Father and I had probably walked by this house, feeling as safe as we could in a demon street, many times, and now here we were hiding behind what was left of it, trying to keep from getting shot. It was about 4 in the afternoon when we got to the Tong people's town. The streets were pretty empty. There were more mounds of rubble where some houses had been. Others had lost their fronts or sides, revealing their insides like gutted animals. Rats skittered over the rubble, blinking evil red eyes at the harsh sunlight. It felt eerie being in the almost empty streets, for they always hustled and bustled with life at this time of day. Now, except for 1 or 2 scurrying people, we saw no one. Our own company building had stood up through the quake. The founder had been careful to select a sturdy building that had good wind and water vibrations, a phrase that meant it was in harmony with the rest of the universe. Uncle was standing in the door, a pistol in his hands. One of his sleeves was torn, and there was a cut over his eye, but otherwise he was as unchanged as the building.
"Well, it's as they say, fools and children have all the luck," he said.
But he looked relieved to see us.
"So, no dragons got you?"
Father stopped.
"And no dragon would dare shake your house, old man."
"Humph," Uncle turned to me.
"You thirsty boy?"
"Yes, but do you have water?"
"No," Lefty laughed. "Only his excellent and venerable collection of wines."
Uncle sighed.
"And I think the earth shaking has so disturbed the wines that they'll turn bad."
"We have been drinking since this morning," Lefty said.
"Better save some of that," Father said. "It'll be worth more than gold."
"That's where Handclap and White Deer are, seeing it's put away where it'll be safe in the park."
We moved inside the company building. It was cool and refreshing in there in the shadows. The ironing shelves had been taken down, along with everything else. The only things left were the stove and Uncle's prized chair, looking lonely and forlorn in the center of the empty room. Uncle sat down in it heavily, the pistol still in his hand. He looked even more immovable than the stove or the building. All of us sat down around him on the floor. It was strange to see the air unclouded with steam and not to hear the sound of washing from the back.
"You must have a mound of stuff in the park," Father said.
"No, just the necessities," Uncle shrugged. Most of it is in Oakland.
That was the city across the bay from San Francisco.
How did you get it over there? Father asked.
On a classmate's boat,
Uncle said simply. Superior men help one another in time of need.
We finished the packing while Uncle supervised us, and by the time we had the last wagon load ready, Handclap had come back. Red Rabbit immediately looked for some sugar in my pants pocket, but he had to be satisfied with my promise of some in the future. It had been funny to see Red Rabbit moving speedily, for him, up the street, for like us, he did not enjoy being around the rats much. We stopped loading for a moment to listen to the crump, crump, crump of cannon.
They are blasting some of the houses with cannon, Lefty explained. They are trying to lay a firebreak by blowing up some houses.
On the way in, Handclap added, I saw them setting dynamite in a drugstore just down the street.
He grunted as he hefted a box onto the bed of the wagon.
Going to start around here, too. You better come with us.
We all urged Uncle to do it, but Uncle shook his head determinedly.
Someone has to watch this building.
But there's nothing left to take but your stove and your chair.
Nonetheless,
Uncle tucked his pistol into his belt.
The superior man tends his own garden.
At that moment, there was a loud explosion that made us all duck, and we saw a huge column of fire and smoke rise over the buildings, flaming bits of wreckage scattered all over. Uncle shook his head.
Those fool demons are using too much dynamite. They must have some amateurs on. Why, on the railroads, we'd only have used half that charge to blast our way into a mountain.
A moment later, we saw plumes of black smoke rise from the Tong people's town. Some of the wreckage must have landed within the Tong people's town and set fire to what buildings still remained fairly intact. It would not be long before most of the Tong people's town, the buildings being almost all of wood, would be on fire. Uncle planted his feet firmly on the ground and folded his arms across his chest.
I'm staying.
Handclap planted his feet just as firmly.
Then I'm staying too, he announced. So am I,
Lefty said.
Yes, we'll all stay,
Father said. Uncle glared around at all of us. He was not used to being disobeyed. He scratched his jaw then, angrily for some time. Finally, he grumbled.
Well, someone with sense better nursemaid the lot of you young rascals. Put my chair in the wagon. But mind you, don't scratch it.
Uncle supervised the stowing away of his ancient chair and then sat down on it. He turned around to look at the building for one last time.
It's just as well. That old building was too drafty anyway.
But he was fighting back the tears. None of us said anything as Handclap clicked his tongue and Red Rabbit jerked the wagon forward. It was a regular tent city in the park when we finally got there. Cooking fires had spread up and down the park, and lines were forming to get the bread or the tents that the demon soldiers were handing out. Other demon soldiers were busy digging latrines. I found out that the demon soldiers had been doing this all day, so there were some good demons as well as bad ones. The Tong people had tried to gather into a group. I saw some tents here and there, for the most part old ones with patches on them or tents improvised out of sheets. There was a particularly dazzling one of bright purple silk sheets. Father and I both recognized them as sheets that we used to pick up from a demon millionaire. I suppose Handclap had picked them up a few days ago, and they had been cleaned but not returned. Out of some perverse pride, Uncle had told them to use those sheets for the tent. White Deer grunted when he saw us.
Good. Now one of you can go stand in the bread line.
Handclap set off with a basket on one arm. We had our own food, but the bread would mean we could make it last longer. We could have the bread for breakfast and lunch if we planned it right. Father, Lefty, and I began to unload the wagon while White Deer started a fire.
Uncle, Father said, do you think Moonshadow and I could bring some food over to friends?
The only demon food we'll have will be the bread Handclap is bringing back, Uncle warned us. White Deer stocked a good pantry for Tong people, but I don't know if demons would agree.
They're a big and little demoness. We've shared some meals together. Anyway, they're not the type to complain.
One of these days,
Uncle wagged a finger at Father. You will appeal to my better side once too often, and my poor, overburdened, sentimental, soft heart will die of the extra load. But till then, Father said with a grin, go on, go on. Uncle waved us away and went inside the tent.
We found Miss Whitlaw and Robin trying their best to erect a tent.
Here, let me help, Father said.
Oh, Mr. Lee, thank goodness you're here, Miss Whitlaw said. We were so frightened. We heard about the soldiers shooting anyone they found in the streets.
Father only smiled and went to work setting up the poles correctly, giving directions to me and Robin. Miss Whitlaw added,
and you must be hungry, Moonshadow. We saved some bread for you.
It was like Miss Whitlaw to have saved half of her own meager dinner for her guests.
No need. We have dinner for you as our guests, my father said.
A real Chinese dinner?
Robin asked.
Yes, I said.
Why, how marvelous. You and Robin should go, dear. I'm really feeling quite full.
But we suspected the truth. Miss Whitlaw did not want to impose upon her neighbors again and ask them to watch their things. Besides, it was evening, and they might want to go to sleep early.
No need to wait behind, Father said. I watch things.
But I couldn't.
It saved me some.
And he shoved us all out of the tent. I was a little afraid then at having to play the host to Robin and Miss Whitlaw. But then I realized that they were probably just as afraid of being my guests. And I thought of what Mother had said. If anyone had been an empress in some former life, at least among demons, if not among the Tong people, it was Miss Whitlaw. All the Tong people stared as we made our way among the tents to the sheet tent of the company. Miss Whitlaw seemed to lose 10 years and become sprightlier.
This reminds me of the circus, Robin, she said as she picked her way over the taut ropes of tents.
Except there's no lemonade to drink, Robin said.
You ever been to a circus, Moonshadow?
No, I admitted.
We must take you when all this is over, Miss Whitlaw said,
and then paused. We had come into a space where the trees and the tents did not shut out our view of the city to the east. The night sky was a bright fiery red from the fires raging in the city. It did not seem like evening, I realized suddenly, but more like a perpetual sunset. Small white things began to shower down. At first I thought it was snow and got excited, but Miss Whitlaw said the white stuff was ashes. I noticed then that everyone had adopted the hushed voices of the afternoon. There was a strange silence over the camp. People did not look back at the city where their houses had once been. The company was waiting inside the tent. They looked a little edgy at having to eat with demons.
Something smells delicious, Miss Whitlaw said.
White Deer looked at me. I translated her words, and White Deer grunted, but I could tell he was pleased. And then Miss Whitlaw brought out the universal gift that is cherished in all cultures. From her hamper, which she had carried over her arm, she took out a dusty old bottle. It was of brown glass, and the light of the kerosene lamp was reflected in it as if there was a little genie trapped inside.
This is a bottle of my very own plum brandy, Miss Whitlaw said to me. Papa used to make it, and I never quite got out of the habit, even though I rarely use it, and, she added quickly, only for medicinal purposes.
Uncle held the bottle between his hands as if it were a delicate flower. We waited expectantly. He turned the bottle around in his hands and then called for the corkscrew. I got it. Uncle studied the cork and then worked the point into the cork as if he were a diamond cutter. He hated to get bits of cork into the wine. The cork came out with a satisfying pop, and Uncle sniffed the bottle.
Delicious, he pronounced.
I had a cup all ready for him. He poured some of the rich amber liquid into it. It looked as thick as syrup. He drank about half the cup and smacked his lips.
Delightful, he said, and poured another cup for himself.
The rest of us tried it. It was sweet and fiery, and seemed to settle in your stomach with a warm feeling, like spring was inside you.
Refreshing, Uncle declared, and poured himself a third cup.
Well, anybody who could make brandy like that was all right with Uncle. At dinner, he even gave Miss Whitlaw, a woman, and a demoness to boot, the seat of honor in his favorite chair. It was an honor that Uncle might not have given the Emperor himself, not even a real Emperor of the Tang people, to say nothing of that upstart Manchu one that claimed the throne. We had forks out for them, but Miss Whitlaw won extra points by asking Uncle to teach her how to use chopsticks. She took so quickly to them that I was positive that she must have been a Tang woman in another life. Robin, though, stuck to fork and knife. White Deer had done himself proud once again. Not so much for the demon's sake, because he could not have known that we would invite the demons, but because of the company's honor. There was a kind of salted fish which is delicious with rice. You break off little flakes, because one flake is salty enough to flavor a bite of rice. There were vegetables, including choy, which is a little like the demon broccoli, only with yellow flowers. There was barbecued pork, roast pork with an oyster sauce, and cold boiled chicken. And afterward we finished off the brandy and sang a little. Miss Whitlaw sang Barbara Allen in a high, ethereal voice, with Robin helping her. The company did not know the words, but the tune itself was lovely, and when I summarized the story for them, the company all agreed it was a fine song. Then Robin recited a poem, The Highwayman, which she had learned to act out in school. It was about how a bandit is saved from an ambush of soldiers when his true love blows away half her chest. I can't remember exactly how she does it, but I think she pulls the rifle of one soldier so that it's pointed right at her breast. The surprised soldier pulls the trigger, and the noise of the explosion warns her lover away. I helped to translate it, and the company enjoyed it. Bandit stories are always popular with us. And for our part, we sang some pleasant songs and acted out some of the stories about Monkey, which we had done once for a guild banquet. All in all, it was a fine evening, and we were sorry it had to come to an end. 3 days later, on a Saturday morning, as we were making breakfast, the camp learned that the firefighters had begun to get the upper hand. Where they got the water from, I do not know. Maybe they used some of the underground cisterns that had been laid down long ago but had been ignored, or maybe they used salt water from the bay. Besides, there wasn't that much left of the city to try to protect now. In any event, we heard that the firefighters were winning, and it was about 7:30 when the rains began.
"Now the rains come," Uncle said disgustedly. He lifted the flap of the sheet to watch it come down.
"We might have had to leave here too," White Deer said. "Things could have gone wrong for the firefighters again, and then nothing would have been saved."
Uncle just snorted, convinced that it was part of the general ineptitude of the deities who were in charge of the universe. He let the flap down. The sheets had already begun to sag on top, and the water ran down into the tent, spattering inside. Uncle sat stubbornly in his chair, opening up his umbrella and holding it over his head.
"A superior man," he informed us, "is above such things as getting wet." "Uncle, how about coming with me to visit Miss Whitlaw?" Father asked. We were all sure that her canvas tent would be drier, and for all of Uncle's pronouncements to the contrary, he was terribly grumbly when he was cold and wet.
Uncle rubbed his elbow.
"What for?"
Father pointed to a box of apples that had been sent down from the north from some of our kinsmen.
"She might like some of those." "You take them. But they're your apples."
White Deer poked Uncle in the ribs.
"Go on. The superior man shares his wealth in adversity."
It was White Deer who had to tend to Uncle when he had a cold.
"Yes, go on," Handclap encouraged. "I'm sure she'd like the fruit."
He probably had the same vision of what it would be like inside the tent if Uncle had a cold. As Handclap said, when Uncle sneezed, he made such a noise that he would scare away the Lord of the East Wind, and he was used to noise.
"It might be good to hear a sensible person talk for a change," Uncle observed, and stood up. "Come, Moonshadow. I'll need someone to hold the umbrella."
Uncle splashed majestically through the puddles of water on the ground, slightly hunched over so I could cover him with the umbrella. The Whitlaws were just finishing tea when we came. Miss Whitlaw thanked us for the apples and graciously asked us to sit in her good parlor chairs. Uncle sat down with the stately dignity he could manage when he wanted to. Miss Whitlaw went outside to where someone had rigged a lean-to out of branches to shelter a fire. She brought in some hot water in a teapot to make more tea. When she had served us, I said, "Uncle's been all over, Miss Whitlaw. He's even been in the mountains."
"Aye there," Uncle said, "working on Central Pacific."
"Why, I had a cousin who worked his way west on the Union Pacific," Miss Whitlaw said. "It was on the other railroad that started from the east. He wrote long letters about it."
Uncle immediately picked up interest when I translated for him. They launched into a long discussion of their memories, both of railroading and of the Sierras. I had no idea the mountains could be so big or so cold or so beautiful. And from there, Miss Whitlaw began asking questions about the Middle Kingdom, and Uncle, given a topic he knew something about, grew even more comfortable. All in all, it wasn't a bad visit. When the rain stopped and Uncle decided it was time to head back, he did not want to dip into their larder by having lunch with them, as Miss Whitlaw urged, we made our goodbyes. Going back to our tent, Uncle twirled the now folded umbrella.
When we have the company set up again, you bring her over for dinner sometime. Then we'll give her a proper dinner.
Sometimes I think there are scales in heaven. And for every good thing that happens in your life, heaven balances it with a bad thing. The company had no sooner warmed to Miss Whitlaw than other demons proved just how malicious they could be. 3 days later, Father and I were over visiting with Miss Whitlaw when we heard the tramp and clatter of the demon soldiers.
"In here,"
we heard a voice say. The tent flap was raised by a young demon officer. One of Miss Whitlaw's demon neighbors was pointing at us.
"Come along, you two," the young officer said. "We're moving you out."
"All of us?" Father asked incredulously.
"Just you, Chinaman,"
the young officer said. "You sabe me?"
Father's hands clenched and unclenched, but behind the young officer we could see a squad of demon soldiers. They were not the same friendly ones who had given out bread and taken care of the refugees. These soldiers all wore the same stern, tense expressions and handled their bayoneted rifles nervously, as if they were in the camp of the enemy.
"I sabe," Father said. "You must excuse," he said to Miss Whitlaw.
"Well, I don't sabe."
Miss Whitlaw rose in magnificent outrage.
"How dare you come poking into my tent and commanding my two friends to leave? How dare you tell the Chinese to leave?"
The officer was taken aback. He became a little less haughty.
"Ma'am, those are the orders. The Chinamen have to go."
"Why? I dare say they make better neighbors than some other folk, whom I won't name because I'm a Christian woman."
Miss Whitlaw darted a poisonous glance at the demon who had guided the soldiers over here. The demon shifted uncomfortably on his feet.
I'm sure, ma'am," the officer said hastily, "but they've got to go. I'm to take them bound up if necessary."
Father got up. There was no point getting Miss Whitlaw into trouble, too. There was a cast-iron frying pan awfully close to her hand, and we now knew just how forcefully she could argue. Father picked up our hats.
"Come, Moonshadow."
Miss Whitlaw whirled around.
"Surely you're not going. You arrived only a moment ago."
Father patted Miss Whitlaw on the shoulder.
"It's some misunderstanding. We fix."
He lied to make her feel better. It was a misunderstanding, but we would not be able to fix it. Nobody short of heaven could fix it. Father handed me my hat. He fixed his own hat on his head.
"We come back quick."
"You come back quick as you can. You hear me?"
Miss Whitlaw said. I nodded. The squad was guarding other Tong people who stood with their gear on their backs or in wheelbarrows. We were marched through the camp with demons staring at us while the soldiers rounded up more and more Tong people. When we got back to the main camp of the Tong people, we found most of the tents already struck. The company was loading our stuff onto our wagon. There were more soldiers there, standing with rifles at the ready, waiting for some outbreak of rebellion. From the way the demon soldiers acted, you would have thought each of us had a knife up his sleeve. A long procession of Tong people, many on foot, marched along Van Ness Avenue,
past the gutted mansions of the rich. What the earthquake had not destroyed, the fires had. At the end of Van Ness, after several foot-wearying miles, we came to a warehouse. Except for Uncle, myself, and Handclap, who rode on the wagon, the rest of the company had walked. Red Rabbit already had to carry several wagon loads at the same time. Somehow he did it. But then, the very next day, we were moved to a parade ground at an army fort near the entrance to the bay, the Golden Gate. I can't remember everywhere we moved or when, but I think Thursday morning we were moved to the golf course at the Presidio, another army base slightly to the east of the Golden Gate. It was as if the demons could not make up their minds. Because it was hard to get fodder for Red Rabbit, the demon soldiers now gave us bread and water reluctantly, let alone fodder for our horse. We sent Handclap south with the wagon to some of our kinsmen. Uncle should have gone, for all this moving around was hard on him, but he was needed to help some of the other leaders of the Tong people figure out what to do. Last year, the demon officials of the city had tried to move the Tong people out of our old area to a place called Hunter's Point in the southern part of the city, where some Tong fishermen already had a camp. It was now rumored that the demon officials were going to make us rebuild the Tong people's town, not in our original location, but down at Hunter's Point. And yet every other ethnic group in the city was going to be allowed to return to its old home site. Friday, we were moved back to the parade ground of the fort near the Golden Gate. Uncle bore this uncomplainingly, although he was sore all that evening. In true hardship, he could be a source of immense strength. By that Friday, we had dwindled from some 25,000 of us to only a few hundred. Many Tong people had just got disgusted and left for points east, south, and north, where you weren't herded around like a flock of sheep by a shepherd who could not make up his mind. But the few hundred who stayed were the hardcore of the Tong people, the stubbornest, orneriest individuals, who were getting tired of being pushed around. Someone had to stand firm. We pitched our tents. They were quite brown now and no longer a bright purple, for the fourth time in 4 days. Nobody spoke too much. Father jammed his hands into his pockets, watching White Deer wash the rice. "We let ourselves be pushed around like a bunch of stupid oxen. Why don't we do something?" White Deer shrugged.
"What can we do? They have all the guns."
Father spat contemptuously on the ground. "That's what we always say when there's trouble."
"And what would you do? Take them all on? The superior man rises above such squabbles," White Deer reminded Father.
Father glanced toward the tent where the old, wise heads of the Tong people had gathered to work out some strategy. You could hear their voices rising.
"They sound like a bunch of old hens," Father said.
"They're trying their best."
White Deer slammed the lid down on the pot.
"What's eating you?"
"I'm sick. I'm sick of greed and stupidity."
"You're just sick of people."
White Deer planted his fists on his hips.
"Maybe I am," Father grumbled.
It was very late in the evening when Uncle came back across the grass, looking very tired, but smiling grimly. He had had to store away his heavy chair because of all this moving around, so he sat down on an old crate instead. But he did it just as majestically as if it were his throne. He poured himself a cup of tea from the tea kettle we had kept boiling all that day. He sipped it while we all sat or stood around, waiting for him to speak. When Uncle finished his tea, he arched his head, grimacing as he scratched the underside of his chin.
"I think we have them," he said with a self-satisfied air.
"What magic did we come up with?"
White Deer asked.
"It was there all the time. Only some of those old fools were afraid to try it. I guess they were afraid of making any kind of trouble."
Uncle fished into his pocket and pulled out a handful of coins. He dumped them by White Deer's boots.
"There's your magical weapons. There's all the charms and spells you need for these demons. We Tong people own 1/3 of the land in the Tong people's town outright. For instance, we own the land that our company was on. The demons can't tell us to move off it if we want to live there. Even they have to follow their own laws. And as for the other 2/3... well, did you ever stop to think how important we are to the demons? We run a lot of businesses and services that they need. If we were to leave this city completely, the whole economy would be wrecked."
But we don't want to go,
I protested.
That's not the point, Moonshadow, Uncle said. All we have to do is threaten to go. They let us rebuild the Tang people's town in the old place, or we go to some city where they'll appreciate us.
Yes, White Deer agreed, warming to the idea. Some city like Oakland or Los Angeles. If you name their rival cities, it will make it twice as hard for them to bear.
That's what we figured.
It's too bad, Father observed, that you have to appeal to their sense of greed.
That's the way it is with demons, Uncle snapped.
That's the way it is with most men, Father said.
I did not see the meeting that Uncle and some of the elders had with the demons who ran the city. The demons tried to bluster and threaten, but Uncle remained calm throughout it all. He played his hand with a confidence that would have done credit to Lefty when he was gambling. Some of the more stupid demons were inclined to let us go, but some of the others, the men who really ran the city and handled the money, knew that if they lost us, their pocketbooks would be hurting. Their hearts and consciences might be hard as flint, but their pocketbooks were as sensitive as a cat's whiskers. To make a long story short, we won the same rights that the demon citizens had in rebuilding on their old sites. We sent out a call then, a call that was heard all around the demon land. Lefty's brother-in-law came down from Sacramento. He was a stonemason. White Deer's youngest brother came all the way north by train from Los Angeles. He was a carpenter. Handclap's young cousin, twice removed, came all the way from Colorado. He had no skills. He just had a strong back, but that was at his elder cousin's disposal. Uncle even got money from some kin and friends in the eastern provinces from whom he had not heard in 20 years. And we were not the only Tang people with kinsmen and friends. Every day, the men came in by the dozens, dusty, tired men who had journeyed by foot and by wagon when they could not afford a train ticket. They would sit for a moment and stretch out their legs, revealing the holes worn into the soles of their boots. They would be covered from their boots to the crowns of their hats with dust. They would accept a cup of tea with a quiet nod of thanks, and maybe smile and maybe make a joke. And after they had finished their tea, they would pitch right in. They might work 16 hours a day without pay, excepting only the food they ate and the straw mats they slept on. We were friends and kinsmen in trouble. The company's days were filled with a cheerful shouting and singing and swearing and hammering. We were putting up a new building, one made of stone and guaranteed to last a century. It was hard work, but it was exhilarating, the kind of feeling that comes from being alive and taking part in some great common enterprise. Only Father seemed strangely unmoved by the experience. He worked as hard as everyone else, but he did so without spirit. Whenever Uncle talked about building an extra large room for Father to work in, Father always kept very quiet. Finally, 4 months after the earthquake, Father came by and found me helping to mark off wood for Handclap to saw.
The Whitlaws are leaving today, he said. I told them we'd say goodbye.
Poor Miss Whitlaw had lost her house in the fire, and so had lost her chief financial support. The money in her cash box was meant to help Robin through college. Miss Whitlaw's land might be worth something once the city was rebuilt, but that meant holding on to it for quite a while. In the meantime, she would have to support herself some other way. Miss Whitlaw had borne her losses with a courage that I had come to expect of her. She had cheerfully taken a job as a housekeeper to some demons over in Oakland across the bay. I put down the pencil and ruler and followed him without a word. We both washed up silently and put on some clean clothes. As we walked through the city toward the park, we could hear the incessant banging of hammers and the wheezing of saws. Wherever you went, you saw the same wooden frames going up, like the skeletons of houses waiting for wooden flesh to be attached. It was a city waiting to be reborn. Father swung his head to the side to avoid being hit by a plank that a hurrying demon carried on his shoulder. He stared after the man.
Look at him. I don't think he's learned anything from the earthquake. He's going to try to make things just like they were until the next earthquake comes along, and then he'll just build another one.
We walked along for a while.
Houses don't mean much. It's the people inside them that are important, I said. Father grinned sardonically.
Yes, and you no sooner get to like those people than they're dead, or they move away, like the Whitlaws.
But we can meet other people, I pointed out. Father playfully tipped his hat forward so that it shaded his eyes.
Yes, and you go on losing those new friends that you make just like you lose the new house you build. Don't you want something better, purer, freer in this life?
I don't think there is, I said doubtfully. Father pulled off his hat and smoothed his hair.
I think an aeronaut is free. I think an aeronaut may be the freest of all humankind.
But you don't have an airplane.
I'll build one.
And how will you live?
I'll put on shows, and people will pay to see just how pure and free a man can live.
He bit his lips thoughtfully.
I think this is my final test, Moonshadow. The final and truest measure of whether I'm worthy to become a dragon again.
I felt as lonely as I had that first day on the pier, looking at the crowd of strange Tong men. I was not only losing the Whitlaws, but Father as well.
Why do you always have to change your life just when it looks like you're finally settling in? I asked.
Dragons are able to change shape, and so must I. Do you understand?
Father glanced over at me. I dropped my eyes.
Do you, Moonshadow?
I still did not answer.
Do you?
I think Miss Whitlaw may be waiting, I hurried on. Miss Whitlaw had already folded her tent with the help of some of her neighbors and carted it off to the temporary army depot. Most of her things had already been stored away in her employer's home. She was wearing a traveling outfit, a long brown skirt with a kind of short cloak of the same material as her skirt. She had on a big hat, which was held onto her head by a scarf that she had tied around her chin.
I'm so glad to see you, she said.
Robin was sitting on a crate, drumming the heels of her high-buttoned shoes against its side. I went over to her. She cocked her head to one side.
You look even darker than you did before.
I've been out in the sun a lot, I said.
Oh.
Suddenly Robin took the book from her lap and thrust it into my hands.
Here, she said. It's a gift for you.
It was The Phoenix and the Carpet by E. Nesbitt.
It's the closest thing I could find about flying, she explained.
I don't have anything that nice to give you, I said.
It's all right,
Robin said, pretending to be indifferent.
I read that book so many times, I got tired of it. All I have is this.
I gave her the carving of monkey that Uncle had given me the first night here. Robin knew what it was, having seen it many times in our stable. By this time, too, I had told her many of the stories about him.
He likes travelers.
She turned it admiringly over in her hands.
Thank you. I got tired of it, too.
I grinned. We loaded the two suitcases Miss Whitlaw had onto the wagon and drove them down to the ferry building. We would arrange to sell her wagon and horse for her. There was always a need for a good horse and wagon over here now with the rebuilding. The whole trip was made in a long silence. In the years we had known them, we had probably grown as close as we could to demons. We made small talk in the large waiting room of the ferry building, which had more or less escaped the fire, though they had had to rebuild parts of it. When the ferry boat was ready to leave, the gate, which looked like it belonged on a castle, went up with a rattle of chains. People were getting up all around us, suitcases in hand. Miss Whitlaw took Father's hand between hers.
You stay true to your dream, Mr. Lee. I just know that one day I'll be going to a show with your name up on the banner.
Then she turned to me.
And you, keep in touch, you hear? Or I will personally walk back across the bay and skin you alive.
I guess that goes for me, too, said Robin.
I hear you, I said. Impulsively, Miss Whitlaw leaned forward and kissed me on the cheek. She was blushing when she stood up again.
Excuse me for the liberty, Moonshadow.
Robin gave me a quick peck and waited defiantly for me to say something, but I did not. Miss Whitlaw picked up one of her suitcases. Robin took the other. We waited by the gateway, watching them walk through the dark tunnel out into the bright light where the ferry boat rode the waves. They walked over the gangplank onto its deck. The gate came down with a rattling groan. The sailors cast off the rope and drew in the gangplank, and the water around the ferry boat churned white as the paddle wheels on its sides began to turn. I did not say much to Father as we rowed back to the Tong people's town. What could I say to a man whom I had come to love and respect, but who wanted to leave me? That night Father got Uncle alone, and I sat down by them. Father turned to me.
Moonshadow, you once asked me who or what caused the earthquake. I don't know. It could have been the gods, or dragons, or demons, or it could have simply been a natural event. It doesn't matter. Supernatural or natural, it means the same. This life is too short to spend it pursuing little things. I have to do what I know I can and must do.
Uncle banged his fist on the arm of his chair.
Not that damned dream again.
Dream or not, I can fly, Father said matter-of-factly. I can build a flying machine. Uncle looked grim.
Even assuming you can build a flying machine and then make money flying it, what will you and your family eat while you're building the machine?
It's time I thought of myself, Father asserted. Uncle was scandalized.
Supposing your father and mother had thought that, or suppose their fathers and mothers had thought that before. That's cheating.
Father sagged in his chair and rested his hands on his knees.
A superior man admits the truth, Uncle snapped.
I could see Father was beat. He hung his head for the longest time, staring down at his hands. I could only think of some immortal who had suddenly woken one morning to find himself in a man's body and realized he was being punished. For the second time in my life, I made an important decision to be with him. I want to fly too, Father, I said.
Stay out of this.
Pardon me, Uncle, but you brought me into this. I looked at Father again. We should build the flying machine. Maybe you can make a living doing it. And while we're building it, we'll both get jobs. We'll all manage somehow. Father straightened a little.
Despite what everyone says?
A superior man can only do what he's meant to do, I said.
Uncle laughed scornfully. Don't give me that nonsense.
He's the only one I hear talking sense, Father said.
Don't expect to come back here, either of you, Uncle warned us.
He was hurt by our leaving him a second time.
I won't have anything to do with fools.
Please let me go with you, Father. I won't be any trouble at all, and you'll need help.
Father put his hand on my shoulder. Yes, I know I'll need help. I was hoping you'd come along.
Why didn't you ask then?
It's not something you can ask.
Then we'll go together, I said.
Uncle looked at us, both hurt and confused.
Why?
He asked.
Why?
It's something we both have to do,
I tried to explain. But it was like trying to describe colors to a blind man. Uncle shoved his chair away from us and got up.
Get away from me, he said.
I was sad about Uncle, but with Father's arm around me, I felt a warm glow inside of me even so. He was Wind Rider, and I was his son.